So welcome to this podcast on anthelmintic resistance, a global perspective. I have with me Professor Jane Hodgson from Liverpool University, Professor Chris Hughes from Charles Sturt University in Australia, past president Dr. David Rendell of EMT Consultancy. Collectively, all three of these fantastic people have a huge amount of knowledge on anthelmintic resistance. So we're going to discuss how things are done differently across the globe and how we can tackle this huge issue. So welcome, Jane, Chris and Dave. How are we all today?
All good.
All good.
Yeah, very, very well. Thanks, Lou.
So look, I feel like we need some warming up here. I feel like we need to get in the vibe. So let's throw out the first question. Let's get you guys warmed up. So what is the extent of resistance in the UK and Australia? How big a problem is this? Let's start with Jane.
So I don't think we know. Obviously, we know there's resistance to BZs and thiamintel because that's documented. But when we talk about the macrocyclic lactone, much more difficult because we don't really do any surveillance and we don't look. But when we do look, we do find it. So as I say, we did four studs and found one of those studs had resistance and the other three had signs of reduced efficacy. And it might quite meet criteria for resistance. So I think it's fair to say we haven't got data. Certainly data isn't easily accessible to actually say for certain. I think we have to be concerned that it is going to be there and you wouldn't be able to assume that your drug's going to work. You'd have to test for efficacy with the glycemic reduction test. And that's the only way you would really know that your drugs are working.
Sorry, Jay, are you talking about, aspirates as well, which I think Chris will probably want to home in on
I think when it comes to aspirates, Dave, you're right. Chris is better than me to talk about that situation. But we already know that the macrocyclic lactones don't work against aspirates in the UK, don't we? So you're looking really at the other two drug compounds there for aspirates, which I think you might be better.
I suppose that anecdotally in the UK, Jane, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but we obviously, the three of us obviously discussed this quite a bit in preparing the EVJ clinical guidelines, which I'll plug because they'll be out online soon. We know we've got resistance to all classes among cyphostomins and ascarids. We just don't know how widespread that is. So I think we probably feel it's fairly widespread, particularly in the more intensive breeding areas and on stud premises. Because your work must have been 10 or so years ago, 2013, 14, that surveillance work was done.
Yeah, that initial surveillance work, but the most recent one, we just looked at those four studs. And as I say, in all four studs, the drugs were compromised against the cyphostomins. And in one case, there was clear resistance. That's the first time we found clear resistance. And we've looked over the last decade, we've looked at time points. So we started early, 2010, then we looked again in 2015, and then we've looked again more recently. And I would have said 2015, 2016. You saw shortened equiappearance periods, so you knew that the cyphostomins were not responding as well to the macrocyclic lactones. But now, the first study we've done where we've gone and just taken four studs at random, one of them has clear evidence of resistance, where 2 weeks post-treatment, the eggs are still there in sufficient numbers to meet those criteria for resistance. So I think we've moved into a space now where, as you say, we can't even rely on those drugs working. We knew there was problems for cyphostomins against BZs and thiamintel. And I think we have to assume the same now, macrocyclic lactones. But we just don't know how widespread.
Yeah. You referred to Katie Bull's study.
that we got earlier this year, in January.
Yeah. And there's also that study that Martin's just done showing that they've been exporting moxidectin resistance from Ireland to Kentucky. So.
And an Australia study. So three independent studies from Irish imports into the US and Australia and to the UK. And my point is, I think we weren't doing widespread surveillance before then, but we were looking and we didn't necessarily find cases of resistance. Now, as soon as we've gone to look, we've just taken four studs. And I agree, they're intensively treated, they're intensively managed and they have young animals and it's a complex situation. But the third time we've looked now, there is evidence of resistance. So I think we've moved into that phase where resistance, mostly drug resistance, applies to yes. It's just a matter of online. And therefore, I think you can't assume those drugs are going to work. You have to test to see if they're working.
Chris, what are your thoughts in Australia?
Look, similar to what Jane and Dave were outlining. Look, we don't have comprehensive data on this in this country, and it is a continent. So, you know, just putting in perspective how big it is. But we know that, just like other parts of the world, we've got BZ and parental resistance in Southeast domains. And as Jane alluded to, we are certainly documenting macrocyclic lactone resistance. And we've done a recent study with colleagues at University of Melbourne and other centres in Australia. Just not sure whether it's been published yet, but where within that we found multiple stud farms, thoroughbred stud farms, where macrocyclic lactone resistance and BZ resistance was present. So similar to what Jane's saying, you know, we're now entering the era of multi-drug resistance, so the stamens. From a Prascris perspective, again, like other horse-producing areas in the world, extensive macrocyclic lactone resistance, and it's very seldom that we find that class of drug to be effective in the populations that we've studied. Concerningly, we have found isolated populations on stud farms where there is fenbendazole resistance. And so similar to what Jane is outlining, in terms of selection of drugs on the individual property, it needs to be done based on actual evidence rather than empirical drug selection.
Yep. So I think we're going to come back to that kind of area a bit later on. But thinking about if this carries on the trajectory that we're going, what are we facing? How big of an issue is this going to turn into?
So if we take Southeast domains first, so one of the things that KT is funded by the HVLB and her project stands a year ago. One of the things that she obviously published the first documented case of a UK-based macrocyclic lactone, both resistant to both ivermectin and moxidectin, earlier this year. So one of the things we were trying to understand is there an increased risk posed to those animals because obviously those drugs aren't working? So one of our questions were, to the studs we were working with, have they perceived at least an increase in parasite-associated disease that could be attributed to Southeast domain? And of the four studs that Katie worked with, three of them all said that they have had cases of bowel surface dominosis they would historically not have seen. That's just their perception. We don't have any actual evidence. We are trying to evaluate that more, you know, in a better way. But anecdotally, there is this feeling that they are seeing more parasite-associated disease that could be attributed to Southeast domains. It's not definitive. And in a sense, they feel that their parasite control is suboptimal, and they do have concerns that they cannot effectively control these parasites. And drug resistance is obviously a big factor in considering what they do next. But actually, they don't have any ideas of what to do next. So I actually don't know what they're going to do, whether they're just going to accept a higher level. Okay, it's still not a common disease, but if you can't control these parasites and you keep using the same pastures year in, year out with young animals, which are already in that risk category, then you would argue that that is what's going to happen, because you're going to have a sequential buildup of those parasites on pasture. You keep the same pastures year on year. I think what caused us slight concern is when we published that paper in January, they had yearlings from 2021 that had drug-resistant parasites, so they didn't respond to either ivermectin or moxidectin. And then the following year's yearlings were grazing the same pasture, and when Katie tested them, they also had drug-resistant parasites because they're acquiring them from their pasture. So keeping that same pasture year in, year out, where the parasites are, but are drug-resistant parasites, you're just passing through sequential groups of yearlings. You know, that's just going to get worse. But I don't know what the solution is. Based on their, you know, what they're not giving us a feel for what they might do differently.
I think that's because they've not been forced to think about it yet, isn't it? I think the nub is they're going to have to dramatically change the way they manage horses. They're going to have to manage them far less intensively, and they're going to have to rotate pasture a lot more. The thing that concerns me is that, well, and everyone, I'm sure, that those yearlings and foals, those ones that are carrying those multi-resistant parasites, they get sold. That's what they're, yes, that's what they're bred for. And they're taking those multi-resistant parasites with them everywhere, just like Martin's paper showed. Yeah. So the problem is, if it's not already, and it probably is, then within a few years, we are going to have universal multi-resistant cyathostomins, and we've already got ascarids. So everyone's going to have to adapt their management practices accordingly. We've seen it already in the sheep industry, not so much in the UK, although increasingly so, but certainly in the Antipodes. Chris might know more about that than me. They accept losses, and they have to radically change their management systems. It's going to be far less palatable to be losing horses as a consequence of the parasites than it is losing sheep as a consequence, even though ethically it probably makes no difference. But
sheep also have the option of other control measures. They have a couple of other drugs that we don't have for horses. They've got nothing else for horses other than these drugs. So it is around behavior change, I think, Dave. But, you know, we're trying to get funding to look at what will drive their behavior changes, what will make them come at this problem differently and recognize that they have to start to use that pasture differently. They have to start to focus on non-drug-based parasite control measures. But from the interactions we're having, it's not, you know, it's that they're yet to really sort of come to terms with that's what it's going to be like. I think they're just assuming that something else will come along.
Can it be reversed, do you think? Is there a chance this can be taken back and completely reversed or not?
I don't think we've really got the answer to that, Lizzie. I mean, certainly when we're talking about a genetic trait or genetic traits in terms of resistance, and whenever these populations of parasites remain exposed to these drugs, we're clearly going to continue to select for resistance. And then the scenario where those parasite populations are not exposed to those drugs at all, will there be regression in the frequency of those resistant alleles? I don't know if we've really got the answer. Jane, have you got any thoughts around that?
No, I mean, I get asked this question a lot. We don't have information to support it. The literature does show that for benzimidazoles, if you have a relatively closed herd, so you haven't got introduction of susceptible parasites into the population, then there is obviously no reversion to susceptibility. And you're allowed to have reversion to susceptibility by, if you remove the drug and remove the selection pressure, what you're asking for is that you can gradually reduce the number of resistant parasites or resistant genes within that population. So you'd have to assume there's a cost to having those resistance genes to those parasites in order for them to become less common. We don't have any evidence that there is a cost to resistance. And if you have a very high frequency of the resistant parasites, which I think is what we're seeing from certainly ascarids against macrocyclic lactones and cyathostomins, or certainly BZ, probably pyrethel, and as we move into macrocyclic lactones, possibly those too. By the time you realize you have a resistance problem, so much of the population is resistant. You've got this massive issue trying to get them back into would be susceptible. But my biggest problem is I don't think that's what we should be asking, because we all know if that did happen, people would just keep using the drugs again. We need to be emphasizing that rather than asking, can we get them to be susceptible again? We should be saying, let's think about non-drug-based ways of controlling these parasites. There are options available to us. Let's use those. And so that if they ever do become susceptible again, we're better prepared not to select for resistance again in the future. So I think, you know, whilst that's an interesting question, and as a biologist, I'm very interested in that, I just think we should be focusing elsewhere.
So I think taking it elsewhere, we think about education, we think about the horse owners, and there's so much education out there that really is working for the drug companies. They've done some fantastic work on educating and supplying tools and various ways that they can try and get this message home to horse owners. But A, is it really working? B, is there something else we should be doing to support them? Or should we be taking it more radical? What steps can we take so they're not just blanket worming these horses? What can be done there? Big question, sorry.
That's Dave, stop that one.
Well, I think everyone knows my views on this subject. I did some work with Tamsin Furtado a while ago, which we published in Vet Record, just looking at behavior change in social science, behavioral science, which I'm no expert in, but Tamsin is. And we applied the COMBI model to this area to look at whether horse owners are likely to modify their behavior based on the threat of antihelminthic resistance and the need for change. And the conclusion that we came to is that no, they're not going to change entirely voluntarily. Some will and some have, but it'll be a minority, and the majority will act like normal human beings act and will always take the easy option. And we're all guilty of it. I'm not suggesting I'm any better than anyone else, but we know that adopting diagnostic led approaches, or whatever you want to call them, is more involved. It's perceived. I'm not sure it's necessarily true, but it's perceived to be more expensive. It's just an extra level of hassle. And when you can go down the tax store and buy an ivermectin for £3, the majority of people are not going to engage in that and cope with that hassle. They're just going to take the easy option. That is human behavior. So I don't feel without restricting access to antihelmintics, we're going to make sufficient inroads, and certainly not quickly enough. Arguably, we've already left it a bit too late. So I feel we do need education, and we need all the other carrots that go with it. But personally, I don't feel we're going to make significant gains without restricting access to these drugs to all players.
Do you think the testing should be mandatory before they're allowed to prescribe anything?
No, I don't think so necessarily. That's the sort of Scandinavian model, isn't it? And I think Denmark's, it's part of Scandinavia, I guess. And it has presented some challenges. It is going to be difficult. There's no two ways about it. And this is why we can't just have legislative change. There needs to be a bigger educational push, equally with vets and prescribers, as well as horse owners, so that vets and prescribers are far better informed than they are now. I think most are pretty well informed. Those that aren't always give the rest of us a bad name, but I think most are. I think I would prefer to see a situation whereby you needed a veterinary prescription to access antihelmintic, not necessarily a diagnostic test, because I think we all know there are significant limitations to all of the diagnostic tests that are out there, and none of them are going to give us the perfect answer as to whether an antihelmintic is required or not. And one would hope that as part of any veterinary-led plan, diagnostics would be central, and vets will be making decisions based on the results of the diagnostic test. But I don't think, and Chris, Jane, I'd be interested in your thoughts. I don't think we should mandate that you have to have a diagnostic test result. Yeah. You can end up with a very artificial situation where people are doing diagnostics for the sake of them, where they're not actually.
Jane, Chris, would you agree with that?
I would. I think being that heavy-handed would be challenging, and certainly within the Australian landscape and context, I don't think that would work. I think there are also situations where there is justifiable use of antihelmintics without necessarily a diagnostic test result to support that use, and we might get onto those situations later. But in terms of your original question and Dave's original thoughts, very similar in Australia. We find it very difficult. That educational piece is very challenging, and I don't think we've made big inroads to that. And I certainly think that social science and behavioural science piece that Tamsin and others have been working on becomes really important. I don't have the answers how best to educate horse owners. I do feel, and I'd be interested in Jane and Dave's thoughts on this in terms of the UK perspective. In Australia, I would say that the engagement with more contemporary parasite control practices is variable across various sectors of the horse industry. And I don't want to cast too many generalizations, but it has certainly been particularly challenging on the commercial stud farm perspective to have farms engage with surveillance-based antihelmintic use strategies. So I think that's a big area of concern, and that's partly driven by where our research focuses may lie, but that's where we're seeing probably the most resistance. You got any thoughts?
I'd say it's similar in the UK.
Yeah, I'd say similar in the UK. It's then sort of big commercial breeding enterprises.
And that's the social science human behaviour aspect again, isn't it? If you've got three horses, it's very easy to do worm egg counts, and you're probably out there poo picking and doing all that stuff all day, every day. But if you've got 100 brood mares that are out in a paddock, getting fecal worm egg counts on them is an absolute pain. Like we all acknowledge that. So it's always going to be easier to take the treatment option.
Going on to the treatment side of things, we've got a lot of multiple actives supplied by licensed or registered pharma companies. What are our thoughts on that? How can we be changing that? And how can we making single actives more available and more known?
I guess questions. The jury's out a little bit on multiple actives. Chris and I probably differ slightly in our views on this, but we don't really have the evidence. It doesn't sit well with me when we're trying to discourage people from applying a selection pressure to then apply two selection pressures or three selection pressures, looking at some of the Australian products, when you just have a cocktail of all antihelmintics in there. It doesn't sit well with me, but there is the suggestion to the contrary that potentially using multiple actives, this is for the same parasite, potentially delays the onset of resistance, and some modeling work that suggests that is a good thing. But the model is only as accurate as the data you put into it. So I just don't think we know. But I think politically it's very difficult on the one hand to be arguing we should reduce our use of them, on the other hand say it's okay to throw three drugs at the horse at the same time.
Would you agree with that, Chris?
Yeah, so it certainly be relevant to cyclostamines and to a degree Perascaris. But look, in terms of combination antihelmintics, when we say combination antihelmintics, what I really mean is combination of two drugs with different mechanism of actions targeting the single parasite. And Dave is right, there is an extensive selection of combinational antihelmintics available in Australia. And what I would say is that the market is flooded in Australia with antihelmintics, and most of them are actually combinations. And like anything in life, if you use them sensibly and with evidence and with structure, that they can be a valuable tool, but without consideration of how best to use them, then they are going to be abused, and we absolutely run the risk of further exacerbation of resistance, and also a sense of false comfort or reassurance that a combination is definitely going to be effective, because if you empirically select a combination by which the two actives are inactive in terms of having a parasite population that is resistant to them, then that's of no benefit to the animal whatsoever. So, look, it is an area, and Dave's right, we need more research. We've done a little bit of research. We've got some more coming out. But it's a small evidence base from which we're working from. In Australia, and I think New Zealand, there is certainly more evidence in sheep with the use of combination antihelmintics. But again, we're talking about different grazing systems, we're talking about different species, we're talking about different parasites, so we can't necessarily translate those results into the equine space.
Just on a practical level as well, I think one of the take-home messages from this hope is that everyone will be doing more fecal egg count reduction tests to look for resistance. And if you've got multiple actives, it's not impossible to do that. I don't know how you manage that practically in Australia, Chris.
Look, we still do have single actives. They're sometimes hard to find, and they're usually combined with praziquantel, which in the context of doing a fecal egg reduction test is not too much of an issue. There are single actives out there, but they are dwarfed by the number of combinations available.
So that would be my concern in the UK. Obviously, we don't have marketed at the minute two actives against the same parasite that don't have different modes of action. We have combinations of drugs put together because they work on different parasites. And for me, the whole sort of simplifying of the message by having those, we're oversimplifying the message and say you can use one drug across all parasites. And that's what we need to be moving away from. We need to be saying what parasite you saw, what do you know about the infection that your animal has, what drug is the most appropriate drug to choose to target that parasite. And by having combinations targeting more than one parasite species that's freely available, you oversimplify the message. You also encourage use of that combination drug when only one of the drugs is the drug that you want to use, because we don't have single actives in for some of these drugs like praziquantel. So you're really, for me, by having combinations, and it's interesting you say in Australia that they dwarf the single actives, Chris, because I mean, that worries me that you don't have those choices then, you know, that you would always have to use two drugs. And whilst we can argue that there is definitely evidence in other parasites, combinations targeting the same parasite can be good. You're also relying on having sufficient susceptibility to both those drugs for that to work. And if you're talking about potentially quite a highly resistant population using two different drugs to target that one parasite species, it may not actually work anyway, but it's an assumption because you're combining the drugs, it's going to be more effective. So I think it's so difficult. And to Dave, go back to your point, I don't see how you can measure the fecal account reduction test without using a single active. It's just too complex.
I found it really hard in Australia when I was working out there to prescribe antibiotics, because you're invariably prescribing a product that's got something in it that you feel you don't need, but you can't just give the drug you want to give, which is the least worst option that I can use, which we're lucky in the UK in that we have the single actives. We do have the drugs with praziquantel, which I agree with you. It would be nicer to steer away from those unless you can demonstrate there's a need for both drugs at the same time. And we're lucky that we have the stand-in of the extemporaneous praziquantel, albeit it's not available through retail outlets. It's only available through vets, but at least we have all the options at our disposal, I think, to make the best possible choice. But again, it's the human behavior piece, trying to persuade people that they need to decide, do we need to treat for parasite A, B, or C, rather than, like you say, Jane, just chucking in the moxidectin praziquantel combination.
I also think that's the prescriber, to some extent, it's their responsibility, Dave, as well, isn't it? Because when you're prescribing, I'm an SQP, I'm not a vet, but I'm an SQP, and part of that prescription process is that you are prescribing that drug because it's going to be used for the intended purpose. Now, having some kind of information to know that that drug is needed and that it is being used for a specific purpose, it's part of that prescription process. So I think there is, you know, our going back to our point about education has been very one way. It's been telling people what to do from experts, rather than actually, we're getting better at it, starting to talk, as Dave talked about the work here, Tams have been doing, talking to actual horse owners, prescribers, all the other vets, all the groups that are engaged in this, what should be a two-way conversation, to make sure that the right drug is being used in the right way. For that, we need lots of drug choice, but we also need to have an informed discussion about what the drug is being used for. And that, I think that conversation is easier to have. So that there's some kind of surveillance through some sort of diagnostic, imperfect as they are, or at least some context in which that drug is being prescribed. And, you know, the availability of different drugs or single actives that can be used as the most appropriate drug in that context. I agree with Dave. Do not be wanting to look at. I had a conversation just yesterday with somebody. What's the least worst drug I can use in this context? You know, we do not want to be having that conversation. We should just be able to say, this is what all the context and diagnostic data is leading to me to believe I need to treat for the parasites. What is the best drug for that parasite?
Again, do you think it's hard for some of these SQPs because they don't necessarily know that single actives are available through special companies? So they're almost restricted in their knowledge on what they can prescribe. And so therefore they are just prescribing these multi-actives, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really difficult to know what's happening at that point of exchange because you get a range of SQPs. You get some very good SQPs who would definitely refer and say, speak to your vet if you're just worried about tapeworms because you can't get the product. I think they're aware of it. I think there'll be some SQPs who are not aware of it. So I think it's very difficult to consider all SQPs as the same. So I think what's probably really difficult for an SQP to do is when a person comes in and wants a specific product, for them to say, actually, no, I don't think that's the right product for you.
Yeah.
You should go and speak to your vet. This is a product that you can get there. And that's a difficult position to put in, I think, as an SQP. Along with, as an SQP, basically being told what somebody wants and trying to dissuade them from taking that product when ultimately the horse owner, the client or whatever, is paying the money and they want what they want.
The other challenge and frustration, particularly for SQPs, I think it's easier for vets, is that they often feel compelled to prescribe in accordance with data sheet. And we know that these data sheets are very out of date. We know that the agri appearance periods that were talked about when these drugs were registered are very different now and far, far lower. And some of these data sheets suggest treating every X weeks with said product, which is just infuriating.
Yeah. I think there is some really good education out there for SQPs that some of them obviously will engage with. But again, it's such a large group of prescribers, and the same, I suppose, could extend to pharmacists who prescribe even though they're a much smaller proportion of overall prescribers. But yeah, I think it is challenging to be the person in that position doing that, even with some support and education, you know, that's giving them the most up-to-date information. Yeah, I think that's a very difficult exchange to have and make sure that you have all the information you need to make the best decision at that point in time. Similarly, you know, you talk to clients who can't really give you the context very well. So you're not actually quite sure what's going on, so what to do with that context. I think SQPs are very clear that if there's any indication of any clinical disease, that you must refer to a vet. It's very clear to them. But the routine sort of prophylactic, preventative, with or without diagnostics, multiple horse grazing with multiple other horses, owned by other people, don't know what the other people do. Those sorts of scenarios are complicated.
That is the scenario though, isn't it, Jane, for most of the time, for vets as well as SQPs. And it used to do my head in. Client comes up to you and says, oh, I'm due to wear my horses. What should I wear my horses? And you throw your hands up in the air. You're like, with absolutely no information, I can't make an informed decision for you. You have to be planning ahead, not doing on an ad hoc retrospective basis. You need a plan looking forward to the year that takes into account all the management factors on your property, the disease risk, the history of parasite-related disease. And this is where I thought every property should have a vet-led plan. And then other people can prescribe antiemetics within that. The vets don't need to sell those antiemetics necessarily, but I do believe a vet that knows the property should be devising a plan. And going back to the question about how we prescribe, I think that's the framework within which they should be prescribed. Don't tie it to diagnostic tests. Tie it to having some coherent plan that is regularly reviewed.
Challenge you have, Dave, though, is everybody has a different vet.
Yeah, and if it's a mixed ownership livery yard, then I think then a vet has to be appointed to deal with that. And that does happen already. Like, we know that I think it's 85% of Beaver members that responded to a poll recently have parasite control programs within their practice for their clients. So the vast majority of vets are doing it to a greater or lesser extent. And I don't think it causes much acrimony between vet practices if one vet practice takes over the parasite control for a yard and other vets see horses on that yard. It's not a big area of fee earning for vets. So I don't think it's that competitive commercially. And I certainly, when I was in practice, both in the West Country and in Yorkshire, I would be doing plans for mixed ownership livery yards and other vets would be treating horses on those yards and they would just roll with it. Vice versa. Far, far more effective if one vet is doing the program for the whole yard. Then you've got 10 different vets doing different horses on the yard. They need to be treated as a herd.
If they're grazing together, absolutely. And I think that often gets, as you say, even if they're grazing in smaller groups, but there's a cohesive plan in place that builds in surveillance. I think diagnostics are best used as surveillance tools. You know, I can never understand why horse owners who are so interested in all aspects of their horse's health don't just want to pay a small fee, 20 years to do a fecal count to see if the horse is picking up parasites, what sort of levels of transmission are occurring on their yard. I find that really surprising that they're not interested enough to know what their horse is being exposed to and what they might be able to do in a non-drug way to reduce that exposure. I just find it's unusual when they are, as a horse owner, having been on a yard for 20 odd years with mixed ownership, they're just not that interested. They don't seem as interested as they should be when they're interested in so many other aspects of their horse's health. And I don't know if that's just a sort of a legacy of routine deworming where you didn't have to think about it, you just did it, or we haven't passed down the education sufficiently well. There's a few examples, I don't know how common they are, of a manager who will make a decision about what the yard has, who is not a vet, who is not an SQP, they're just a yard manager. And in my experience, some of those are quite challenging because they have very specific ideas of what they want to do and they don't seek veterinary advice or they don't really have any external output and everybody just has to do what they say. So I think we have to make sure that horse owners start asking more questions. Prescribers have everything they need. I agree with Dave. The best way forward is definitely to have a forward thinking plan that brings in all relevant context to allow you to make the decisions about treatment, of which diagnostics will form a part, but so will pasture, you know, control of parasites through pasture management. And that has to be the way forward. And then SQPs and vets prescribe in that context. I mean, I know, Dave, you're really keen that vets are the prescribers. I understand why, but I think we have to also prepare ourselves for the fact that that might not happen. So then we put in the next best thing, which is vets who are ultimately going to deal with the challenges presented by poor parasite control, actually in position to take some actions to try and prevent disease and be consulted in some way about those plans. I think that's a very positive move.
Sorry, Chris, excluding you from the conversation, but that's often the best way. I don't have any issue with SQPs prescribing and generating health plans. And I think we all know there are lots of exceptionally good SQPs who are very, very interested in the subject, more than some vets are. I think that the challenge, though, for SQPs is they don't have, and unless their companies are going to get behind them and invest, they're not going to have systems of retaining and recording patient data. They're rarely going to have knowledge of the property. And they're rarely going to be in an environment where they can actually have those conversations around health plans. They tend to be operating more in a retail environment where there's always three other customers waiting. So it's not a knowledge issue. I think it's just the logistics issue. And I think vets have a lot of advantages in putting those plans together. And one of the other big factors is we're talking about this in isolation because this is a parasite control podcast. But these health plans should be incorporating many other things as well, other infectious disease control and biosecurity and other welfare issues on the property. So to me, this is part of a wider PrevMed piece that we should be doing more of on a question property.
And I think that would also reinforce this idea that parasite control is something that you just reach for a drug and give it. You know, it's more complex. You need expertise and advice to get the best information, to do the best thing. I think having it within the context of a plan, a herd health plan, or however you put it, reinforces that it is an important part of your horse's health to manage these parasites properly. And that issue needs to be considered and evaluated. And it isn't as simple as you might have thought it was, just to go and buy a drug over the counter and just give it to you.
Chris, what are your thoughts? You're sitting there very quietly.
Well, look, when you're on a podcast with an ex-president, you just sort of sit back and take note.
I mean, we could bring it here that he spelled your name wrong, so you can just go for it now and attack him.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't let that one go, don't you worry about that. Look, different situation, but similar challenges in Australia. And, you know, we're in a position where there is utter convenience and unregulated accessibility to anthelmintics. And so, For a good proportion of the horse industry in Australia, I still think we are in a position that Jane was talking about of reaching on the shelf and just getting the drug and without any associated thinking of around should we be using this drug? Should we be using anthelmintics in this situation? What are other components of sustainable and integrated parasite control? So, you know, I think moving forward, and I guess coming back to an early part of this podcast, there does need to be a level of probably both in Australia and the United Kingdom and the United States and other areas, restrictions on anthelmintic availability. Because until that comes in, certainly in Australia, that the level of accessibility is quite extraordinary. And Dave will probably be able to reflect back on his time over a decade ago now where any saddlery, any produce store in Australia, they've got a range of anthelmintics available. And that is not a position where there is going to be any informed advice provided. And it's probably similar to the UK. And the work that we've done on a couple of surveys, that veterinarians or the veterinary industry is seldom relied upon for advice around parasite control. So owners are much more likely to get their advice from the produce store or something that they read or something that someone told them rather than informed advice from an adequately qualified professional. So I think slightly different challenges similar challenges, but with slightly different contexts in Australia.
And is that unique? Is that unique amongst, when you think about it, anthelmintics are drugs. But in terms of their sort of free availability, something I've never really understood is that's kind of a unique setting, isn't it? You don't have that for any other active compounds, do you? That are just essentially so readily available.
The only other things would be ectoparasiticides in Australia as well. I can't speak for the United Kingdom, but
some vaccines. Yeah, it's all geared towards the farm animal sector, isn't it? And it was the same in the UK. There was the Competition Commission report, the Marsh report back in the early 2000s. And making a very long story short, essentially it was decided it would be better for animal welfare to have these drugs more widely available, because then there would be more competition, they would be cheaper, more people would use them, and that would be better for animal health, which clearly was the most spectacular own goal. But it's very hard to row back from that now, because there's a whole industry geared around it that's making money from selling them and likes the free access to them. It's very, very difficult to undo that.
And it's also sent the message that you don't really need to worry about thinking about these parasites, because, you know, it's not really a big problem. I think it's really fueled the idea that where horse owners might be concerned about other things, it's just not something to be too worried about, because, you know, it's never been that important. And we're trying to claw that all back and say, actually, it is really important. You do need to do diagnostics. So you do need to think about context. You do need to think about how your animal becomes infected. You do need to think about all those things. I think it's made that job much harder.
Yeah.
I think the message is definitely getting out there. You know, you talked about the SPD earlier, and that it's a blanket. You've got to wear them every 4 to 6 weeks. And that certainly has changed. That mindset has changed among horse owners. So the message is getting there, but it's almost just a bit too slow at the moment, isn't it?
And I think it's considered too complex. And the reason that I think there's sort of whoever controls it, ideally a vet controls that plan for a particular yard, is attractive, is because I think the other thing that people have realized, we need to move away from interval treatments. They know that. They know that's a really bad idea. But they know that fecal endcaps are a good idea, although they're not quite sure exactly how to use them. But there's this kind of void where they feel a bit like, I want somebody to kind of help me and tell me and guide me. And it seems so complex to them. You know, they say frequently, oh, she's so complicated now, parasite control. She's so complicated. And, you know, because it went from very simple routine administering, what they see now is quite complex. And I think the advantage of the sort of herd health plan idea, or instigating some kind of overall, at least an oversight of what's happening, and recommendations around what should happen as the first prescription, could bring some, not simplicity, but could make them understand that actually you can have a clearer route to better parasite control that doesn't leave you on your own trying to interpret different things. Because I do hear horse owners say that a lot. Oh, it's just so complicated now, I can't get my head around it.
Mm-hmm. And I think to round up, because we've certainly covered a lot of ground chatting about this, but maybe if we could get one take-home message that you wish every vet knew. Dave, maybe you go first.
I would just urge every vet and practice to engage with developing plans for their clients. And probably the best hook for that is to start by doing some fecal count reduction tests. Even if you do them FOC to start with, demonstrate they've got resistance, and then hopefully you can hook them into the need for a wider plan that you can put together.
Chris, do you want to be next?
Dave stole my thunder. Look, I think it's integral that we, as a profession, we realize, and Jan alluded to this earlier, we are really stuck with the drugs that we've got, and we are not going to have any new drugs that are developed specifically completely new actives for the equine parasite control worldwide. So we need to use what we've got responsibly, and that comes back to what Dave said in terms of establishing property-based plans, and also making informed decisions of what are the most appropriate drugs to use on a property. And we can only do that by fecal count reduction test.
That's the first time he's ever agreed with me.
Jane, maybe you could round us off.
Yeah, I don't think there's any more to say. I mean, I think given where we started with this conversation, which was about what do we know about resistance and how widespread is it? I think really now any athelmintic that is used has to be evaluated as to whether it's working in the way that you expect it to work. And that has to be by using a beak leg count reduction test. So we've all said that. I think that's really important. But the other thing I think, if I was to think of what vets ask me, and I only get a small number asking me, they're probably the ones who are less well informed, should we say, is remembering that the parasites are resistant. The parasites are inside the animals, but it's the parasites that are resistant. And so those parasites are on pastures. So you can have animals that can sequentially pick up resistant parasites over several years because of the pasture. And horses often graze within a herd. So thinking about the herd is really important. So if you're a vet managing one animal, the number of times I speak to them, they say, oh God, yeah, of course. I need to think about this is what's happening with the other animals that that horse is co-grazing with. So coming back to this idea of if an individual animal is grazing alone, fine. But if it's grazing in a wider context, you have to take the wider context, the herd level, co-grazing cohort level into consideration.
Thank you, Jane. That was brilliant. And I think just to finish up, we've certainly got a lot of work to do. There's a lot of education that needs to be done. There's a lot of changes that need to be done, but there is hope on the horizon. I think we can make those changes. I think globally across the water, we can all come together and have plenty of ideas to make these changes for the better. So thank you all for joining me today. And thank you, Chris. I know it's late and you're being called by the birds out there. So thank you very much. And we will say goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you.
These podcasts are aimed for registered vets and veterinary nurses. If you're listening as a pet owner, then we always advise that if you have any concerns about your animal, then please consult with your local veterinary surgeon.